Tonight on The Download, housing activist and Dr. King photographer Bernard Kleina. From the Squirrel Nut Zippers, Jimbo Mathis. And live music in Studio 435 from Indie Rockers, A Sports Boyfriend. Now, here's your host, a man who is questioning his bargain bin winter glove purchase today, Justin Kaufman.
I really thought I cheated society when I went to Menards in the spring and I got that $4 pair of gloves. You know, and I was like, this is, I can't believe it's so cheap. And then today when it was cold and I was shoveling, I was like, I now know why these are so cheap. They were freezing. That moment when you think you've won, but you've actually lost. That happens more frequently than we like to admit. Hey, everybody, it's Justin Kaufman here in the Martin Luther King Day holiday show. The Download with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We've got a great show lined up tonight. Bernard Kleina, housing activist and longtime photographer, will join us in the 8 o'clock hour at the big table to talk about his memories and recollections marching alongside and documenting Dr. King when he came to Chicago as part of the Chicago Freedom Movement back in 1965, 1966. He's just a guy who was like, I want to learn more about Dr. King. He obviously had interest in activism. Went down and had a chance to document, and some of those photos, the photos that Bernard Kleina had shot those days, became some of the most iconic photos of Dr. King we know. So we'll talk with Bernard Kleina about his life dedicated to fair housing. It's the 50th anniversary of fair housing, the Fair Housing Act. So that's coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. I personally today felt like. It's funny because, you know, I was thinking about what I was going to do on MLK Day. Because a long time ago, I read this great commentary about that the holiday is really, truly about giving back. It's about community. And I always have this grandiose idea that I'm going to go do something. You see people on Instagram, Facebook, other places that are just like posting photos of being at prayer breakfasts or pancakes or doing something for the community or doing something outside of their comfort zone. And I'm always like, next year I'm going to do that. Next year. Today, I was like, okay, so I was with my son, he had the day off of school, and I was like, all right, let's go shovel, right? And because, I'm not going to get into a long story about why it's not shoveled, I pay an exorbitant amount of association fees monthly, still not shoveled. Don't get me started. I digress. This is about MLK Day. But... yeah, I went outside and we shoveled, and I told him, I said, the duty today is that we're going to shovel our neighbors as well. Again, all of this is moot if the shoveling company would have done what they were supposed to do. But, again. So anyway, you know, it was really funny because he was shoveling and it was like, oh,
it's hard. Yeah, the snow sticks to the sidewalk.
Yeah, it wasn't even that hard. We're talking about three squares of sidewalk. You know, it's not like we're talking about a lot of people in the Chicagoland area listening today to do driveways and walkways up to there. You know, like, actually put some work into it. My little thing is like, I'm going to do 1, 2, 3. Okay, I think that's enough. We did it. He's complaining. Oh, God, it's so hard. I wanted to say to him, I'm like, yeah, it's really hard when those kids had to desegregate the Arkansas schools. They didn't complain as much as you are right now. Was shoveling the neighbor's walkway. I was like, you're defeating the purpose. You cannot complain while you're doing community service. You have to I'm trying to teach 10 years old. I'm trying to teach him like he can't be that down on helping others. Like, what is that? Are you getting this from me? I felt like an 80s commercial with the drugs, you know, the dad. Like, I learned it from watching you, Dad. Am I doing that? Like, I'm making dinner. I'm like, oh, God. Maybe I didn't know, like, he was watching me shovel and I was already complaining. I probably was. I was complaining about the association, not like the people not doing it. You're right. He is learning it from me. I love it. All right. So that one neighbor to the left of me, that was my MLK Day community service today. Next year, we'll do more. All right, coming up in the show tonight, like I said, we'll talk with Bernard Kleina. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy will be here. We'll do Touche. Lots to talk about. Is it a noun? Is it hole or is it house? I love that that's now the argument over the president and his words. No, he said house, not hole. Oh, got it. So we'll talk about that coming up. Also, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, excited for this, Jimbo Mathis from the Squirrel Nut Zipper is going to join us. He's got two shows at Space coming up. The Squirrel Nut Zipper is a great sort of swing jazz, calypso, klezmer band from the 90s. One of the bands that truly brought that era back. If you remember in the 90s how alternative music came on, but there also was this big band kind of revival. I was thinking about the Mighty Blue Kings here in Chicago and other places, but the Squirrel Nut Zippers were on Letterman, they were had heavy rotation on XRT, places like that. We'll talk about how that's 20 plus years ago. The Squirrel Nut Zippers continue. Jimbo Mathis joins us in the 9 o'clock hour, and live music from the indie pop band Sports Boyfriend in Studio 435. So we got a lot to do tonight. So let's get to it. News, weather, and traffic with David Jennings, Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by my man Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is the Download. A show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. So stay with us. It's a Download here at 720 WGN. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. It's Dr. Martin Luther King Day in America, a day to reflect on community and spirit, or buy a new mattress. One, two. Or in the case of some Chicago area schools, a snow day makeup. Also a day when our president has to tell the media, I'm not a racist. Strong start. Strong start to 2018. Anyway, let's get to the news. An MLK forum on crime and criminal justice reform featured some of the gubernatorial candidates running for governor in the state of Illinois. And when Republican Jeannie Ives blamed crime on the lack of fathers in the House, Chris Kennedy responded by saying, well, I wish I could agree with you. I didn't have a father in my life. Somebody shot him. Wow. Talk about stepping in it. And he got a standing ovation from the crowd, then he left early. Classic mic drop moment for the Democrat challenger. And that's the kind of line that can turn an election quick. Although, what do I know? I mean, I thought Lloyd Benson had it in the bag after the "You are no Jack Kennedy" line back in 1988. I mean, I was 14, and he and Dukakis ended up losing to George Bush and Dan Quayle. So, what do I know? Dan Quayle. Still, after, I mean, we're talking 30 years of presidential politics, and Dan Quayle still towards the top.
How do you spell potato?
Exactly. The Winter Olympics are getting closer to starting, so why not scan the wire for Olympic news? Oh, okay. How about this one? Simone Biles, one of the heroes of the last summer Olympics, has come out and said that the doctor that worked on gymnasts also sexually abused her as well. The story is an outrage. We love the athletes who come out and compete for our country. They're not hotshot pros with millions of dollars, and a lot of times they're 15 or 16, and they've dedicated their lives to this. All we ask is that they're taken care of by our country, and they're adults. Dude's already in jail for molesting other gymnasts on the U.S. team, but adding little Simone Biles to the list, and as much as I'm happy that the doctor's getting his, he's getting sentenced this week, what's up with U.S. gymnastics? Some of the gymnasts are also saying that they were pressured to keep quiet. Where's the Trump tweets on this? Less about the fake media, more about this. So many stories this weekend. The biggest has to be the false alarm notification that told residents of Hawaii that a missile was coming their way and they should seek shelter. I mean, I've heard of human error, but there's a difference between a package not coming on time and mass hysteria from nuclear war. Also, I'm all for preloading these messages, but I don't know, maybe write it out in the moment. To avoid haphazardly hitting the wrong button? I can't even imagine. Where's the president on this? What does he have to say? I'm so conditioned to read a story and then go, I wonder, where's the president on this? I go check Twitter and then it's all the defensive nonsense. You know what? I'm okay that he doesn't weigh in. He weighs in enough already and it's already nighttime and according to his schedule, he's either eating KFC in bed or sleeping. The Sunday morning talk shows were ablaze with accusations and lies and inaccuracies. And for the first time, that was the topic. It wasn't just their reporting. Senator Cotton told Face the Nation that he did not hear the president say bad words when talking about Haiti and African nations, and that Senator Durbin was essentially making it up for political gain. And the president denies that he said it. But then again, even Republican senators have backed up the accuracy of the reports. So who are you going to believe? I guess this is where we put history, recent history, to work. Do you believe that the president didn't say it and that the Democrat senator from Illinois is just making it up to embarrass him? Or does it sound like something the president would say and has a history of saying things similar, including a whole campaign to question the birthplace of the previous president? And according to many fact-checking organizations, has lied more than Pinocchio after a night out in Vegas. We just stayed in a room all night. Either way, I will say this. I do have a point of contention with the story. If the president did say this about those countries, he did say it in a closed-door meeting. It doesn't make it right, but it also means that it wasn't meant for public consumption. The senators and the media made it public consumption, and I'm not sure that's the same. The president should know better, no doubt, but he's definitely not the first president to use language like this in the White House. So again, it's wrong. But it's much different than if the president said it directly to the press, to his campaign followers, or to the country. So the media getting all excited to swear because the president said it, it's not necessarily true. Nixon dropped the F-bomb a ton of times in those recordings. That doesn't mean that you go on a 10 p.m. news and do it tomorrow, right? And that's my hot take. Well, warm take, tepid take, 4 days later. Also, Dickie Durbin. Hilarious, right? It's hilarious. In weather, it's winter. In sports, the Bulls had a matinee at the UC today, and then they blew a 15-point fourth quarter to eventually win by 8. That's the way it could you be a more pessimistic way to report a news score? They blew a 15-point lead, but they still won by 8, but that's not enough. They beat the Miami Heat, which is a big deal because the Heat had won 7 in a row and have skyrocketed to the 4 seed in the East. Everyone's talking about them being the upstart surprise team of the NBA season until they ran into the Holiday. And I'm not talking about MLK Day. I'm talking about guard Justin Holiday, who put up a game-high 25 points. And another big game for Lauri Markkanen, who hit a big 3 down the stretch and had a 3-point play, as the Bulls are 2-0 in the Zach LaVine era. Still 10 games under 500. But you know what? That's semantics. Also, Markkanen became the fastest player in NBA history to reach 100 three-pointers in a season in his career. Isn't that amazing? That's amazing. The Bears retained coach Vic Fangio to run the defense. That's a huge move for the Bears to keep the consistency from last year's unit, which at the end of the year was top 10. Really? Actually, in the 3 years Fangio has been at the helm, they saw improvements in every defensive category, hopscotching like 20 teams. I mean, they still lost all the time, but it's like when we say, remember those defenses of the 70s? Doug Plank, taking people's heads off? Yeah. Classic 7-9 Bears. Actual NFL insiders are saying that Matt Nagy has put together an amazing staff. Gotta love all the positive press the Bears are getting after their 5-11 season's over. We get more positive press in the offseason than we do in the actual season. Speaking of the NFL, the Vikings dominated the Saints yesterday. Oh, you know what? Oh, wait. Wrote that too early. Used the wrong word. Dominated should be replaced with squeaked by because the Saints safety missed a tackle like he had Stephon Diggs on his FanDuel team. It was ridiculous. That was just awful. I had found joy for a moment in the fact that the Vikings were going to be upset again. And now my football misery continues. Could you imagine if the Vikings go to the Super Bowl and play in their own house? Ah, it's too much purple. And Blackhawks bye week, they entered this week after a sloppy showing yesterday at the UC, getting walloped by the Red Wings. Like I said, they're the seesaw of Chicago sports. And finally tonight, the Cranberries lead singer Dolores O'Riordan. Is that how you say her name? Close? Yeah. Sorry, she died at the age of 46 years old. That's terrible. It's too young to die. The Cranberries will always have a special place in our hearts, especially for my generation who stopped listening to them because Q101 played them every other song. They ruined it. Rest in peace. It's true. That's the carryout for January 15, 2018. A new study says that carrying out is adding to the obesity rate in this country as more and more people are doing it. I'm okay with that if you are. Yeah. All right, coming up, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy, Touche. Got a lot to talk about. At 8 o'clock, Bernard Kleina joins us to talk about his life advocating for fair housing and his life photographing Martin Luther King. That's coming up on the download, 720 WGN. Stay with us.
just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right, you go right, you go left.
Well, touché, that's right. It's Monday night here, and that means Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling are in studio to talk about the news that always seems to hit over the weekend, especially out of the White House. Lots to talk about tonight. We'll talk about what happened with the president's words behind closed doors. We'll talk about DACA. We'll talk about spending. And we'll get in a little Hawaii, too. DACA. How about that? Does that sound like a good January segment for us here?
You know, happy Martin Luther King Day. I can't think of a more appropriate Martin Luther King Day than one where the president is quoted saying, "I'm not a racist. I'm the least racist guy you'll ever interview."
There you go.
There you go.
That may have been Reverend Dr. King's vision.
Right.
To get less racism in the presidency,
I guess so.
Over time.
I mean, this is not going the way that the president wanted it to, or maybe not. I'm always confused about what he actually wants and what he's doing by having these things come out. But first, let's talk about yesterday, Face the Nation, other places. You saw Republican senators and others kind of coming out and denying that any of this stuff that Senator Durbin talked about, the S word and the hole, and then the White House said it, oh, it was House. I mean, there's a lot going on here, but the first part is that this has become the argument, and immigration is secondary.
Well, to me, the significance here is this thing happened on Thursday. Story broke Thursday late afternoon. There was no denial from the White House. There was no denial from the White House first thing in the morning. The only thing the president said was kind of a non-denial denial. There were no denials from the other people in the room. It took them, 3 days in order to come out with a denial? And even when they did, it was kind of a weak denial. I mean, come on. I see my friends in the right trying to justify this, trying to defend, trying to do whataboutism.
Who? Which friend of yours?
Not
on
you.
The right?
And actually,
which
I would like to
of yours on the right.
I would like to give Chris
this.
Roebling credit for
Thank
something.
You. Thank you.
This may be a first in the history
no,
of Touche. But I would like to give Chris Roebling credit because unlike some of his fellow travelers on the Trumpkin right, Chris actually came out foursquare, condemned this.
Well, because he's the head of state. You know, our president is both chief, you know, head of government and head of state. And I don't think any head of state should be caught speaking this way. All heads of state have spoken this way, but they haven't been caught. And when you're in a room with Dick Durbin, you know that he does not wish you well. And he's going to say whatever he's going to say. I agree with David. There was no conclusive and, you know, declarative denial on Thursday night or on Friday morning. What you did have, I think that Senator Perdue actually spoke on Friday morning and was not covered, but that's a minor point. My point is he was caught saying things that folks in his position should not be caught saying. But to your original question, Justin, we don't need this conversation right now. We need DACA to be resolved. We need the government to be funded. We need chain migration to be ended. We need the absolutely mindless lottery system to be tossed out the window. And we need funding for border security. So the basic four elements of the deal remain. And Democrats can have all the field day they want about how bad Trump is. Hallelujah. Go ahead. Do it all you want. But we still, the business of the country moves forward.
But it also, I mean, doesn't it put a lot more pressure on the position that the president takes, especially when it comes to immigration, where he says, I want immigration from countries that can help our economy. I want people who come in who are going to stimulate or not. We're not taking in other countries' bad hombres, if you will. But I mean, there's something. Does it hurt his position that he's on the record or not on the record? But now there's all this behind closed doors of what he said. Does it hurt his position and hurt him that this has become the story?
Trump is a master of self-destruction. every time he gets just a little momentum, he does something like this. So he actually had a little momentum coming off the tax deal. He had that little show where, you know, he he tried to pretend he was in charge, only to be held back by Kevin, it's not Kevin Brady, it's the other Kevin in your party. McCarthy, yes. Who said, no, you don't want a clean DACA bill, because he didn't understand what a clean DACA bill was. I mean, this is hurts him, and it hurts the ability of the country to move forward. Look, Democrats want a deal. There are many Republicans who want a deal. But when the guy at the top does things like saying, you know, why do we have to have more Haitians? Why do we have to have people coming from those poopgate countries? You know, why can't we have more people from Norway? And you're like, dude, could you be a bigger poster child for racism?
I don't think that the statements are necessarily racist, and I think that that is an unfair characterization. My concern is United States leadership and the fact that these countries have been called out. But to get to the policy requirement, Democrats have for years said it's a broken system. Republicans for years have said it's a broken system. Folks tried under G.W. Bush to get it changed. That got swamped. Folks tried under Obama. That got swamped. Here you've got, regardless of what he said or didn't say on Thursday afternoon, Trump did lead that meeting, notwithstanding David's jaundiced view of the meeting. He did lead that meeting, and he showed all America that the news cycle from the prior 72 hours that he's, you know, incompetent and insane and, you know, bouncing off the walls, it was all hooey, Democrat, yeah, leftist, right, hooey. So he comes in, he does a great job at that thing. And yes, he's got some momentum and things get diverted, right? And I'm trying to make the point that the only thing slowing down a deal at this point is Democrat intransigence.
What's the deal? What would be a good deal for both? Let's role play. The Democrat senator and the Republican senator in the room, what's a good deal on immigration and DACA?
Well, a good deal, what I think is going to be the middle of the outcome is do DACA, do the full DACA deal, provide some money for border security. Democrats aren't going to want to call it a wall. Republicans are going to want to say it's a wall. Be nonspecific about that border security. Do things that are going to strengthen the borders. That's the deal. It's there for the taking. I totally disagree with Chris. It is not Democratic intransigence that is preventing a deal. It is the Republicans incompetent. And to your point, Chris, of I don't agree with you about the characterization of the meeting where the president clearly didn't know what he was talking about. But even if you,
it was a 55-minute meeting, and you're referring to a 32-second bit of a 55-minute meeting.
No, it wasn't,
David,
just the 32-second bit.
It's absurd what you're saying.
Even if I grant you what you're saying, if he wanted to show that he wasn't some crazy loony right-wing guy, racist guy, yet kind of undid that 24 hours later.
Well, the deal, I think, is pretty much what was discussed in that meeting in the cabinet room. And so what you're talking about is a transformation, a DACA transformation. Absolutely. What you do with the Democrats is get back to the bill that they all supported under Obama, which had full funding for 750 miles of wall. David says you put some amount of money into this thing. And, you know, I don't know if it's $18 billion or $23 billion. And there are folks in D.C. who will say, oh, my God, if you do 18, you're not doing this. Or if you do 23, you're doing it. But whatever the number is. But you because all of the Democrat leadership voted for that brand new wall for 750 miles. Start with that. Get that going. And then chain migration no longer has a constituency.
You've got to stop saying chain migration.
And you get rid of the lottery, and now you're in business.
This is a point that Dick Durbin made to Donald Trump personally, sitting with him in that very same meeting. He said, Mr. President, please stop using the phrase chain migration, because to a large segment of America, the African Americans, their ancestors came over in chains. It is offensive and demeaning to them. And yet when you use that phrase, you really hurt your case. And Trump's response was, well, that's a good line, Dick.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's no, not a good line.
Yeah, it
it's, a,
yeah, it's a good line, Dick,
it's offensive.
There are about 150 press releases from Democrats in Congress talking about chain migration and how important it is. So this is all selective outrage, which is exactly what Durbin...
Can we all as a society recognize that what we've done or said 5, 10, 15 years ago, press releases, whatever, we can make a transition that's insensitive? I mean, I don't understand why we can't all say,
yes,
stop using that word.
No, we don't say them anymore. Because you're talking about chain migration from Democrat press press releases 3 weeks ago. So Dick Durbin is not there to get a deal. Dick Durbin is there to energize the base for November. Dick Durbin is not there to promote the interests of America. Dick Durbin is there to try and get a Democratic majority in the House and possibly even in the Senate.
Actually, the president's taking care of that for us, but thanks very much.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio tonight. We're doing Touche, our regular segment we do Monday nights here. When we come back, let's talk about spending, and let's talk about what happened in Hawaii this weekend and how that has political connotations as well. Dave, Chris, stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Touche. Right. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio tonight. Obviously, spending is an issue. I mean, we're seeing with the... Let's talk about that, because obviously if there's no immigration deal, there really isn't a spending bill, right? I mean, or a plan. We're going to have government shutdown on the list as another thing we got to deal with coming up here?
You know, Democrats might shut down the government.
Democrats have been being really good citizens by agreeing to all these continuing resolutions when, in fact, all they have to do is say no. So they've done that pretty consistently. Democrats don't like to shut down the government because they actually believe in the government, whereas Republicans love to do it.
No one does.
So the question is, will it shut down? You know, the expectation is there will be another continuing resolution and it's another false alarm, kind of like Hawaii.
Yeah.
Hawaii.
269 said it's difficult to imagine the fear in Hawaii, the people in Hawaii experienced. Thankfully, Trump quickly assured everyone it was a false alarm, except he didn't. I have a question about politicizing
really,
it.
I mean, this points out the fact that Hawaii has no radar. They've got no satellite system. They don't know what's going on. And yet they have this mechanism, which is an emergency. And all states have emergency management, you know, for
Tuesday
floods
tests,
or
yeah.
hurricanes, whatever, tornadoes. But these guys, I mean, this is so sad for the folks who were affected. And it reveals this disconnection because the Defense Department knows what the heck is going on. And I watched that whole press conference with four or five guys who came up and talked about it. And then I watched the Hawaii Congress lady. I haven't heard anybody say, oh, and that's when Elmo picked up the phone and called the Pentagon to say, are we under attack? Who is minding this story?
What's the political angle here? Because the congresswoman from Hawaii kind of...
Tulsi Gabbard.
She kind of called out that this is asking Trump to to get back to negotiations with Kim Jong-un. Made it political in a way that I'm not sure he necessarily had anything to do with.
Yeah, no, I don't really think it has anything to do with that. I mean, it was a sneak preview of an eventuality that is unimaginable. And so I think that... It kind of freaked everybody out that this happened, but it also reminded people that we really have very limited defenses, and this is a possibility. Fortunately, I still haven't heard the president say anything about this. I haven't heard him say anything. I haven't heard him tweet anything. So I have no idea what the White House's position on this is, but it seems like there's a larger question for states, to Chris's point, of what do they do? How do they do it? How are they supposed to engage? Should it be as simple as a guy, during a shift change, a guy goes to do a test and pulls the wrong, goes one step too far on the drop down menu, the way we might order a pizza. Instead, all of a sudden, you freak the heck out of, millions of people.
You know, it's easy to politicize it. And that's what I think the Congress lady was doing. And I think, ill-advisedly. And, nobody turns to her for advice on strategic
anything,
policy. So her point was political and irrelevant. The relevant point is we have had a period of global peace because of concern over the use of nuclear weapons and because of rational actors controlling those weapons and because of mutual assured destruction. So you have three elements there. And what you're getting, what we are all experiencing and what we're concerned about with Kim Jong-un and with the mullahs in Iran is irrational actors getting their hands onto nuclear weapons. And then you have the terrorist dimension. So it is, folks who haven't seen On the Beach, a phenomenal movie from the 1950s about a nuclear holocaust. Or if you haven't seen Failsafe,
I prefer Failsafe.
Yeah. Failsafe will keep you up at night. And of course, the comedy version is Dr. Strangelove. But you know, you got to take a look at some of these things, and you've got to put yourself into the moment when all of the conversation's over. And that's what we've avoided for 50 years. And we've still got to avoid it now. Find a way to do so with North Korea.
Okay, let me ask the question about, you know, the congresswoman at her point, politicizing, putting it aside. The point was, let's figure this out. Let's figure this out with North Korea now.
That's not exactly her point.
But she's saying go to the table and let's negotiate something. Where, I mean, is that something that we all should start pushing our administration to say enough of the tweets, enough of the drills, let's get to the table, negotiate, and put us in a situation where we feel safer?
Yeah, I mean, look, Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman who is a veteran, lost me when she started being an apologist for Saddam.
Kim Jong-un.
Hafez al-Assad. Bashar Assad, his son. Shows that we're
in
old
Syria.
People. In Syria.
Oh, yeah.
But the question of whether there should be, quote, negotiations, what does that look like? Because one of the points that I've made repeatedly is that Donald Trump has established a marker. And the marker is that in order for him to win, North Korea must give up their nukes. North Korea is not giving up their nukes. So what does that mean? Where do we go? What is the middle ground? I don't think that there's a middle ground that gives North Korea their nukes quickly.
That was the policy of Barack Obama. It was the policy of George W. Bush. It was the policy of Bill Clinton. And it was the policy of George H.W. Bush.
American policy.
Been American policy that we want a denuclearized peninsula and that North Korea has to cease its nuclear program. That is not new.
Yes,
What is new is, I think we can all agree that we have seen North Korea as a major focal point for Trump from his first dinner with the Chinese president. He has probably spent more time on this than any other
diplomatic initiative.
Yeah. And he's got a lot of results to show for it. The ratcheting up of UN sanctions, the frequent meetings of the Security Council, the multilateral approach. And what we see at this moment from North Korea is what we have seen before, and that is, well, don't worry about any of that. We want to talk to our friends in South Korea about coming to the Olympics. And this is a sort of a diversion of attention and a stall tactic. North Korea is a very serious problem. It takes a heck of a lot of attention.
Yeah, I have a little different perspective, because what happened is that Trump challenged Kim as to whose button is bigger and more effective.
That's where we lose.
What Kim did under Donald Trump is test larger and larger bombs, including, we believe, a hydrogen bomb, and larger missiles that now have the range to attack the entire United States.
We got revved
developed
up right
under
at the end.
Barack Obama, because he never did anything about North Korea.
Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy will pick it up next week.
Yeah.
Guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, David. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Jimbo Mathis from the band Squirrel Nut Zippers is going to join us. They got two shows at Space in Evanston coming up this week. Squirrel Nut Zippers, sort of swing jazz, calypso, klezmer band from the 90s. They just celebrated their 20th anniversary of their album Hot. They had radio play back in the day. They kind of were instrumental in bringing that swing jazz movement back. You know, it was obviously a huge era at one point in our country, and that music returned. The Mighty Blue Kings here in Chicago and others, that music became popular again, and the Squirrel Nut Zippers out of North Carolina were a big part of that. So we'll talk with Jimbo Mathis, who's back in Chicago this weekend. Well, it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day today, and many are celebrating with activism, reflection, and honoring community. The holiday and the man have deep roots in this area. It was then State Senator Harold Washington who pushed for the state of Illinois to dedicate a holiday. That was a big article today in the Tribune. And of course, King came to Chicago in the mid-60s to advocate for fair housing and what was called the Chicago Freedom Movement. That movement led to the Fair Housing Act of 1968, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Also celebrating its 50th anniversary, the news, obviously, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, in which Chicago burned that summer, April 4th, 1968. There are many stories about when King came to Chicago back in the mid-60s and marched in Marquette Park. Rocks were thrown. King was injured. Bernie Kleina was a young man at the time who had a camera. He took his camera down to Chicago. He was living in Elmhurst at the time. And he ended up marching alongside King and taking some iconic photography that's still used today. And out of that experience and the experience he had already had in the church in Selma, Alabama, Kleina dedicated his life to activism and fair housing and continues that pursuit from his offices in the western suburbs. Tonight we talk about King's impact on Chicago, housing, and of course, my guest, Bernie Kleina. Bernie, welcome to the big table.
Thanks a lot, Justin.
It's great to see. It's great to have you here, and it is amazing to see your photography and all the stuff you did with King back in the mid '60s. This is the 50th anniversary of not just his assassination, but also the Fair Housing Act. What does this day mean to you? What does it mean that we're in the 50th anniversary of an act that you've dedicated your life to?
First, it's almost impossible to realize that it's been 50 years since King was assassinated. And I think back then I thought we would make a lot more progress in fair housing, in human relations, in race relations than we have. And what is sad and I think sometimes scary is that this last year we seem to be going in the wrong direction. And I hope that can be changed.
You know, the Fair Housing Act, it's so interesting to think that that came out of the Chicago Freedom Movement and other movements around the country. But how much of that was part of your purview as a young man in 1965? How much were you recognizing that this issue, the issue of fair housing, would be something that you would dedicate your life to?
In 1965, I knew nothing about fair housing. And I think I was pretty naive. I was a white boy growing up in a white grammar school, a white high school, pretty much white college, university. And it was never an issue for me. And it wasn't an issue until in 1965, I was watching TV and I was watching marchers being beaten and tear gassed and trampled by horses that I realized I couldn't just sit on the sidelines, that I had to go down to Selma, Alabama. And going down to Selma changed my whole life. And so it was pretty much of a learning experience for me from that point, and I've never looked back.
You were a man of the cloth. You were a priest at the time when you went to Selma, Alabama.
I was a priest. I was a Catholic priest, and at that time, Dr. King called clergy, Catholic, Protestant, every denomination, to come down to Selma to join in the protest, and that's what I did. And I found, a little bit to my surprise, that I was sort of accustomed as a priest to be treated nicely, you know. But that wasn't the case in Selma, nor was it the case in Chicago when I was involved in demonstrations. In fact, they would single me out and other people, other religious people, because we were like the conscience of those sometimes throwing rocks and cherry bombs and bricks, and so it was a new experience for me.
I would assume that. I mean, being from Elmhurst and being a Catholic priest and obviously the respect that goes with that, and go down to Selma, Alabama, heed the call from Reverend Dr. King. You would think that, yeah, you're right, that there'd be some respect, but you walked right into it. I mean, you were arrested at the time. This was not, here comes the Catholic priest, let's all show reverence, right?
You're right. There was no reverence shown. And in fact, the week before I went down to Selma, there was a minister who was bludgeoned to death by whites in Selma. And so I sort of knew what I was getting into, but I didn't really. As I say, I was naive, and I thought, well, I'm going to go down and change things and make things right. And as I often say, Selma did much more for me than I could ever do for Selma.
Bernie Klein is my guest, a longtime housing advocate, priest, also photographer. We'll talk about that. Took his camera down to the Chicago Freedom Movement when Dr. King came to Chicago to advocate for fair housing here on the west side of Chicago and also march downtown. Bernie Klein was right there. We're talking with him tonight on the Martin Luther King holiday. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we will continue our conversation with Bernie Klein at the big table. Stay with us. My guest tonight at the big table, Bernie Kleina, the longtime housing advocate in the western suburbs, also a photographer, a priest, a civil rights activist who we're talking to tonight because he brought his camera down to the Chicago Freedom Movement and the marches that Dr. King had when he was in Chicago in 1965 and 1966 as we enjoy the waning hours of MLK Day 2018. Mr. Kleina, I'm fascinated in – so you're in Selma. You get arrested, you come back to Chicago, and not that very long after, the story goes that Dr. King came to Chicago to march for fair housing.
Right. It was 6 months after Selma that Dr. King came to Chicago, and I like to say that Dr. King followed me to to Chicago. I mean, it's not true, but I like to say it anyway. But he came to Chicago specifically to focus on open housing, which we now call fair housing, and ending segregation and slums in the city.
This was a big part of the civil rights movement that seems to be long forgotten. The idea we all know about race relations and inequality and a lot of the civil rights protests that stayed in the history of our country, where you see the images on TV of protests and hoses and things of that nature, and lunch counters. But a lot of it had to do with segregation. A lot of it had to do with changing our housing policy at the federal government level. Dr. King was very active in what now we know to be the fair housing movement.
That's right. And I'm still annoyed after all these years that fair housing is kind of a stepchild of the civil rights movement. On this day or other times when we celebrate Dr. King, they show photos of King in Alabama, in Montgomery, Selma, Atlanta, and elsewhere, but you never see Dr. King in Chicago. And I think people forget that he not only worked here, he lived here, and he was involved in a number of demonstrations, which he said were more violent than anything that he faced in the South. So I think there's maybe we in the North try to hide the qualities that aren't as great as we'd like them to be. And so we kind of keep that side of us hidden.
Bernie, you're coming back from Selma. How, you know, you tell the story, and obviously your photography tells the story, that you had your camera and you wanted to document this. This was something that was important to you, to see Dr. King, who you marched alongside with in Selma, in Chicago.
Well, one of the things that I noticed immediately was that Dr. King was blamed for everything. So when there were demonstrations and there was violence, he was responsible for it. So I thought, I need to document that and show that it wasn't King, but it was punks and others in Chicago or elsewhere. Now, the question is, why did I think I could do that? prior to photographing Dr. King, which, by the way, they're now in the Smithsonian, my photographs. But before that, I was just photograph families, photograph vacations, and that's it. And but I like to remind people or encourage people that if you wait until you think that you're completely ready, it's too late. And so I just picked up my camera, which was fairly primitive by today's standards, and photographed Dr. King, but not just Dr. King, but other civil rights leaders, also those who opposed violently Dr. King's marches in Chicago.
When you came down, I mean, because there's a few marches. I mean, in Chicago, they'll always specifically talk about the march in Marquette Park, where he went to Marquette Park and he was hit by a rock and he was bleeding. There were a lot of marches at that time. He marched to Soldier Field at one point, City Hall at one point. There was a great tweet today about the list of demands he posted on the City Hall, the doors of City Hall. There was a lot going on at that time. It wasn't just this march in Marquette Park.
That's correct. There was a lot of things going on, and there was also a lot of criticism against Dr. King because he was talking about open housing and fair housing, and you know, you can make changes at lunch counters, drinking fountains, movie theaters. You can change those overnight, but you can't change housing overnight. And that's what I think a lot of people misunderstand, that Dr. King comes up and they're like, well, wait, nothing has changed that much. And but it's because he's not about moving people out of their homes. Right. I mean, the change comes slowly, and the change is still taking place.
Well, at the time, and it all, it's funny because last week we had Claire Hartfield in, who was an author. She wrote a book about the 1919 race riots, and a lot of that had to do about territory and geography and neighborhoods butting up against each other and segregation, self-segregation. There were no segregation laws on the books in 1919 in Chicago, but the neighborhood self-segregated. When you think of the 60s, that's around the time after or during white flight. Redlining was a big thing here in Chicago. We've talked to other people about this on the program when we talk about history. There was a lot going on that was encouraging or cementing segregation in this city.
That's right. And Dr. King, when he came, he tried to do what he could. And for many people, it wasn't enough. But fair housing is the kind of thing that's going to take a long time to resolve. And it's still something that we're working on. Unfortunately, some of the issues that Dr. King faced then, we're still facing today.
Well, I'm fascinated because, you know, what did Dr. King do when he came here? Talk about his staff going out and conducting tests and talking about the real estate offices and really uncovering what was happening at the time when it came to Chicago segregation.
Well, I have an interesting quote from him regarding testing. He said, "We sent Negroes in large numbers to the real estate office in Gage Park. Every time Negroes went in, the real estate agent said, 'Oh, I'm sorry, we don't have anything listed.' Soon after that, we sent in some of our fine white staff members into those same real estate offices. And the minute the white person got in, they opened the book and said, 'Oh, yes, we have several things. Now, what is it exactly that you want?' The sad thing was, of course, that's sad enough. But the sad thing is, we're still doing the same kind of testing today, and in many cases, finding the same results.
Bernie, as someone who had marched alongside in Selma and come here from Elmhurst to document this, to make people see that it wasn't Dr. King that was starting the violence, or that so many people had criticized him for, were you surprised at the way that Chicagoans reacted to Dr. King? Were you surprised at what was happening in places like Gage Park or Marquette Park, or even some of the vitriol that was thrown against him when he went to march to Soldier Field?
I was very surprised. there were times when I would go and photograph to document what was going on, and other times I joined the marchers. And in this one occasion, especially in Marquette Park, I was, as you mentioned, a priest, and these young guys are throwing rocks and cherry bombs and bottles at me, and they have Saint Rita and Saint Leo on their T-shirts, and I'm thinking, there's something wrong here. You know, we should be on the same side, and clearly we're not. Some of those marches were very violent. That one in particular was violent. When we got back to our cars, virtually all of them were either pushed into the lagoon, windows were broken, tires slashed, and the only car that was not injured in any way was mine. And it was kind of a fluke. It just so happened that when I got there in Marquette Park, I parked between two police cars, not intentionally, but that was it. And my car at that time looked like an unmarked police car, and so nothing happened to my car, but everything imaginable happened to everybody else's cars. And so instead of anyone getting in their cars there, we had to walk down, I think it was 71st Street, to Ashland, which at that time was the dividing line between black and white. And the people were throwing stones at us and, as I say, cherry bombs until we got to that point. And then they weren't quite so brave when we walked across Ashland and into the black community.
Bernie Klein is my guest tonight, housing activist, former priest, photographer as well, who documented Dr. King coming to Chicago for the Chicago Freedom Movement. Some of those photos, as mentioned, are in the Smithsonian. They're some of the most iconic photos we know of Dr. King. Bernie Klein and my guest tonight at the Big Table. We'll continue the conversation after we get an update on tonight's news. Stay with us. Thank you, David. It's Download here, 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the Big Table, Bernie Klein, a longtime housing activist, former priest, and I guess you would say amateur photographer, but the photography that he took of Dr. King when he came to Chicago for the Chicago Freedom Movement back in 1965, 1966, is on display in museums across the country at the Smithsonian. It's part of the new Chicago History Museum exhibit that just opened on Dr. King. Bernie Klein, I mean, your work, why do you think it stands out? What do you think it is? Because he's a very well-documented figure, Dr. King. I mean, you see so many different photos. Why was it that your photos from Chicago and the Chicago Freedom Movement, why do they stand out?
Well, if you look through book after book after book, every photo of Dr. King will be in black and white.
Yeah, right.
And mine's in color.
Ah.
And it's a case of ignorance is bliss. I didn't know better at the time. And I was not even an amateur photographer at that time. I'm a professional photographer now, but that wasn't the case then. But, you know, you learn by doing, and I always have, and it's paid off.
You're absolutely right. I mean, when you think of the iconic images of King, they're always in black and white. Even the I Have a Dream speech, everything that was so, yeah, you're right, to shoot in color, to see those shots, especially the ones that you showed me that are on your website, Bernard Kleiner Photography, BernardKleinerPhotography.com. Yeah, they're amazing. I mean, it's all in color. It's a very vibrant look to Chicago, and even though it's the same stuff that you'd see in black and white.
Some people have asked me, when did I add color to the to the photographs? I said, no, I shot that way.
The Fair Housing Act came out in 1968. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary this year of the Fair Housing Act, which was something that was near and dear to Dr. King's heart. The Chicago Freedom Movement was 65, 66 when he came through here. We had Congressman Danny Davis on last year talking about the movement. We did the anniversaries, the 50-year anniversaries of the movement. It's now 51, 52 years. But the Housing Act, how did we get from what was happening in Chicago advocating for fair housing and open housing to a federal act?
Well, sadly, the Fair Housing Act came about very quickly as a result of the assassination of Dr. King. Had that not happened, it probably would have taken years more for the Fair Housing Act to become law. And so it's sad that that's what it took. But you had two senators, Senator Brooke and Senator Walter Mondale. They spearheaded the movement after King died and got it passed. Sadly, that's the part that King played as far as the act is concerned. Now, since 65 and 66, he was pushing for open housing and fair housing. So there was momentum going on. But it wasn't until he was killed that the act came about. And part of the reason why the act even was became law is because Senator Brooke, a Republican, talked about when he came back from World War II as a soldier, he was denied housing here in the States. And I think that resonated with Congress and the Senate, and so the act was passed. Unfortunately, though, when the act was passed in 68, it really didn't have any teeth to it. And it wasn't until much later that that the discrimination could be
Interesting, that was fought, added to it, yeah. You know. I always wonder about it. You know, as someone who marched in Selma and also here in Chicago and has dedicated your life to being an advocate for housing, Was it at the time in the late 60s, was it the same everywhere, that there was discrimination everywhere? Was it worse here in Chicago? Was it better here in Chicago? Like, tell me about what was happening here as opposed to the country when it came to the fight for open housing.
Well, Chicago at that time was the most racially segregated city in the country. So in some sense, Chicago was worse than other cities, but not that unusual when you compare them to other northern cities. Ironically, northern cities were more racially segregated than cities in the South. And yet the North really didn't want to face up to that problem.
Yeah. And forgive my ignorance, and I was thinking about this today, and I'm like, well, maybe I won't ask it because everybody in the world probably knows the answer except for me, but what does the act do? I mean, what does it do to set out, what does fair housing mean from the federal statute that is called the Fair Housing Act?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because many people think that the Fair Housing Act simply protects people of color. And the truth is that the Fair Housing Act protects everybody at some time in their life, protects unborn babies, it protects little children, it protects old people like me, people with disabilities, families with children that are trying to rent apartments. There's still a great deal of discrimination. It's not. It might not be as blatant as it was in the 60s, but it's still there, still on the internet. You'll see apartments advertised, and they'll say something like a two-bedroom, but the limit is two people. And what that does, it imposes a great deal of more expense on the part of families looking for housing, because then maybe they have to look for that three-bedroom unit, which is pretty pretty elusive.
You do a lot of work advocating for fair housing in the western suburbs, and it wouldn't necessarily – I wouldn't necessarily think of DuPage County as a place that would have a dire need for that. And I'm not – again, that's my ignorance in the way that I would think that that's something that might be more particular to what's happening in the city and the more inner city part. But that's not true. There is still a lot of issues when it comes to fair housing happening in the suburbs of Chicago.
Right. When I back in the 80s, middle 80s, in an article in the newspaper, or editorial, I should say, they had me as the most disliked person in DuPage County because we were litigating on behalf of families with children, on behalf of people with disabilities, on behalf of African Americans and Latino families. And one major change, I think, or a couple of major changes, is that in when the act was created, it was pretty much a black and white issue, at least in our minds and in the enforcement. But all the discrimination that's still going on really affected everyone, but we didn't really see it as clearly as we see it now. So now you see discrimination against families with children, discrimination based on race and ethnicity, against people with disabilities. It's still amazing to me how many cases we have that where there's discrimination against persons with disabilities, where an apartment complex refuses to make an accommodation, what's called a reasonable accommodation, so that they can park close to their unit. And some managers say, well, you know, if we do it for one, we'll have to do it for everybody.
Yeah, right.
No, you don't. It's just for persons with disabilities. Also, we had a case in a nearby luxury high-rise, newly built, and the condo association or the condo building included all of the required handicapped spaces. But what they did then is they sold those premium spaces to people who didn't have a disability. And so as a result, our client, who is disabled, had no place to park because, as you know, the parking lots are graded, and, yeah, and he couldn't go up or down without considerable assistance. Hmm. And of course, they sold those spaces because they're wider spaces. People could fit two cars in the space. And
that's interesting.
And so that's just, you know, one.
Those
one
are the
example.
Things that you have to deal with in 2018, especially when you think about the fact that you're right. Back in 1968, it applied to one particular situation, one that was being advocated by Dr. King. Bernie Kleina in studio with me. You know, I got to ask you, I mean, this will be the 50th anniversary as well as the assassination of Dr. King. Chicago, after the fact, in April of 1968, rioted. A lot of places in Chicago, the south and west sides of Chicago, burned. What was your take at that point when you were watching this happen, when Dr. King was shot, and what happened in Chicago?
Well, I was shocked, first of all, that he was assassinated, and then I was shocked at the riots that were going on. But maybe not surprised in a way. I mean, I was so angry that someone could take the life of this man who, had he lived even to today, maybe life would be different in this country. And so I wasn't surprised. There was just so much anger built up in the community because of the discrimination that was going on prior to the assassination. Yeah. So he had people already angry. And then when King was shot, it just all overflowed into the streets.
It's the irony, of course, and maybe irony is not the right word, but that Dr. King had been someone who was advocated for nonviolent protests and peace and those kind of things. To have riots and to have the violence that happened after he died, how do you think he would have responded to that?
Well, I brought with me one of his quotes that I think is right on point. He says, "There is nothing more dangerous than to build a society who feel that they have no stake in it, who feel that they have nothing to lose. A riot is the language of the unheard. And we must honestly admit that there are several things that America has refused to hear. America has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and equality have not been met. Social justice and progress are absolute guarantors of riot prevention." And I think he said that before those riots, and I think that's what he would say now.
Bernie, for you, spending your life being an activist, an advocate, the experience that you had with Dr. King, what's it mean to you when you look back on a day like this, on MLK Day, and get a chance to tell your story on the radio? What's it mean to you that we're at 50 years and that you've dedicated your life to this pursuit?
I thought I'd be through working by this time. But I've actually been busier in many respects trying to educate people on this issue, helping them understand the role that Dr. King played and really still plays through his statements. And this is why I do like to bring in some of the quotes, because on Dr. King's birthday, you always hear, "I have a dream." And that's, you know, a beautiful speech. But there was so much more to Dr. King than that. And that's what I'm doing now, trying to go around the country with my photographs. Hopefully they'll inspire some and help people better understand that what Dr. King said then is as relevant then as it is now.
You could see those photographs at the Chicago History Museum. There's a new exhibit on Dr. King. You could also see them in the Smithsonian. Bernie Klein is my guest. Bernard Klein at photography.com is the site. I can't thank you enough for coming in to talk about your life with Dr. King, but also talking about fair housing and reliving 50 years since the act began in 1968. I really appreciate you telling your story and being my guest tonight at the big table. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
My favorite part of that interview was the fact that Bernie's car didn't get thrown in the lagoon. And it's true, like if there was probably a lot of protesters at that point, you know, who were very safe and felt powerful and brave to be throwing rocks at Dr. King west of 71st Street and get to Ashland, they're like, "Well, I think that's enough. I think this is good right here. Well, I think we made our point." Yeah, that's great. It's amazing to think about that. You know, and the photography, and you can check out his stuff. It's at Bernard Kleina. The website is Bernard Kleina, Kleina, photography.com. And a lot of his photography is on display at the Chicago History Museum, which just opened, I think it was today maybe, or maybe last week, the Martin Luther King exhibit. And like you said, they're in the Smithsonian, they're everywhere. It's really great stuff, too. And he's right. Like, the fact they're in color, you don't even notice it. But it brings this... It really does. I know that sounds kind of hokey and maybe just making it up because it was on the radio. But I noticed earlier, it brings a vibrancy to those photos, you know, of King that you've seen over and over and over. But when they're in color, you're like, wow, this is stark. This is stunning. And you don't even recognize it's because it's in color and everything you know is in black and white, right? But yeah, I mean, to think about the conversation we had last week with Claire Hartfield, the conversation we had with Natalie Moore, we talked about her book, Southside. We've had a lot on the download talking about history and how housing has been a big part of segregation when it comes to redlining in the real estate community and people not welcoming other ethnicities to their neighborhoods, especially people of different skin color. You think about Dr. King coming here and not just doing what it's a different time now, but activists come to an area to highlight something and they might stay for a day, press conference, and then, you know, Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton go somewhere else, or, you know, not to pinpoint just those two, but others. I mean, to say that you're going to come to Chicago after Selma, Alabama, and spend months here to move in, to highlight a problem that obviously needed fixing. And then his assassination led to the Fair Housing Act, 1968. It's been 50 years. And as Roe pointed out in the crosstalk, I think it was last week, that some of those protections of redlining in the real estate industry is what politicians like to call, quote, regulations. And they were rolled back last week. Some of that stuff's on the books for 50 years. And it's not lost on me that our president also has a side hustle, which is real estate. He's a politician first. What he does as a hobby on the side is real estate development, we all know. But it's not lost on me that I can understand how that regulation might actually get in his way. So good conversation to have, on MLK Day. Coming up, we're going to have a conversation with the Squirrel Nut Zippers. Talk with Jimbo from the band. Talk about, 20 plus years now. It's just early to mid, I think it was 1996, 1997, that kind of area, in which they were in heavy rotation on the XRTs and the Q101s of our time, with a couple of their hits doing swing jazz, kind of bringing that back. Chicago knows it very well with the Green Mill and Mighty Blue Kings, but the Squirrel Nut Zippers were integral in bringing that sound and that style and that culture back. I mean, it wasn't just that. It was like people were dressing and putting out the mousse in their hair to put a little curl in the front. It was all Squirrel Nut Zippers. So that conversation coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Stay with us. Thank you, David. This is Download 720 WGN coming up. Jimbo Mathis will talk about his life, the helm, the head of the Squirrel Nut Zippers. Nice little swing jazz, klezmer, calypso, hot jazz. I think that's what they call it, hot jazz. Is it hot jazz? Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm making it up. I could make up like the sixth word in that sentence. I could just make it up and people are like, oh.
Hot klezmer.
Yeah, hot klezmer. Hajubu. It's a great. Oh, you don't like Hajubu?
Yeah. All right.
Also coming up in Studio 435, the indie pop sound of Sports Boyfriend be our band tonight in the live music segment we have every Monday night, Studio 435. You good?
Sorry about that.
You all right? I was worried about you there for a second.
My apologies.
What's happening? I'm like, I quickly was like, we gotta get upstairs.
No. I'm sorry. That was my mistake. I goofed. I should have hit another button first. I'm so sorry. Sorry.
No apologies. We're just happy you're alive. It's not an emergency situation. Pete, did you watch football this weekend?
Did I watch football?
All the rage, huh?
Oh, my God.
Oh, gosh.
Spent a little too much time watching football.
I tried to not watch it just out of, you know, respect for the fact that the Bears were out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was annoyed because I think it was Saturday. I was downtown, and it was kind of desolate. It was a little desolate, like, where we were at. It was cold, of course, on Saturday. And I was like, you know, if the Bears were good, like, and I'm not saying, like, world beaters. I'm not saying Super Bowl champions. I'm just saying 11-5. 10-6, even a 9-7, just to squeak in, maybe get a game at Soldier Field. It would make everything about Chicago better at this time of year.
Right.
The whole city come together, people be downtown, tourism be bustling, people be excited for what was going to be happening, an event we all come together around at night. And it's just not there. Like, you're watching other cities get this opportunity to show off their Philly cheesesteaks. how much snow and cold it is in Minnesota.
I know. A lot of people at Giordano's and Gino's are upset they don't get the file footage of them making pizzas.
That's right. I love that all the other big cities, they have, you know, they've got a delicacy. They got a food to taste in Minnesota. They're like, it's cold. They never go to, like, the normal, like, they don't go downtown Minneapolis and be like, look at them, they're eating the Minnesota bratwurst. No, instead, it's so cold outside. It's always so cold here. That's kind of funny. But yeah, I was annoyed. I got more annoyed at the Bears than I probably should have. I should have just been relaxed. The season's over. But I got more annoyed when I was downtown and there was nobody down here. I'm like, there should be a game. I feel like if there was ever a time for the argument of whether or not we should subsidize with our tax money or tax dollars the rehab or building of new football stadiums, there should be a clause in the contract. When they did that back in 2003, whenever they won, whatever it was, I think it was right around that time where they redid Soldier Field. Mm-hmm. They should put a clause in that contract that said, and if you don't make it back to the playoffs or give us a Saturday night Soldier Field in a national spotlight game, you got to start paying back every year. Like, it almost, it's like reverse mortgage. Like, they got to start paying us back.
Yeah.
Because that was a big deal. Like, we had to pay a ton of money. And for what?
Nothing.
For a couple of for 8 Sundays a year?
Spend 3 hours on Saturday watching the Texas Tech Red Raiders basketball game when there's no football.
Maybe a Beyonce concert once in a while? Give me a break. I was just annoyed. But I was annoyed. And then I got more annoyed when the Minnesota Vikings won that game. And I had a friend on Facebook say, well, my civic pride is overtaken by regional pride. Go Vikings. No.
No. No.
Sorry. I know there's a lot of Minnesota fans who listen and are fans of the download, and I know. But we're in downtown True Blue Chicago right now. I'm on Michigan Avenue. It's very hard for me to put away old rivalries and root for the Minnesota Vikings to win it all this year.
Well, I wouldn't expect somebody from Minnesota to root for the Bears if they were in the same position.
Yeah, right. Watching that game yesterday, I was the only solace, the only emotion I had in the whole day of being down. My second team, you know, Martyr's not here tonight, not because of the holiday, because he's probably crying over the Steelers losing. But that was my second team. So to watch them lose and lose in particularly dumb fashion, and then to watch the Minnesota Vikings kind of crumble. The story of that game never isn't being told, that the Minnesota Vikings choked.
Mm-hmm.
They were winning that game by 17 points, and they let the New Orleans Saints take the lead with 20 seconds to play, 25 seconds to play. And if it wasn't for a fluke play in all of fluke history, the Saints would have beaten them, and it would have added to their misery.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's not there was a point I was texting with my brother, and I was like, giddy. I was like, oh, it's so fun to watch the Vikings lose again. And then they won, and I'm like, I'm going to bed. Like, I'm out. I don't even know what time it is. I'm out. Nothing's going our way.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the other part, I thought this was funny. On Saturday night, I watched the Patriots and the Titans, and it was on the TV, and my wife was like, is there anything else to watch on TV? And I was like, babe, it's 28-7. There's a chance that the Titans come back. You're in the fourth quarter of a 35-7 game or whatever. And, you know, I was getting something from the kitchen, came back, and she was watching it. And she goes, this guy again? And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, the reason, she had the greatest point. I was like, this is an amazing point. She's like, everyone talks about, Trump loves to talk about how the NFL ratings are down. And it's because of all this protest, kneeling at the national anthem. Some say it's because of concussions.
Mm-hmm.
My brother's a theory that the big markets, New York and Chicago, have down teams. And I was like, no, it's that the storyline has not changed. It's that every year, Bill Belichick in a dumb hoodie and his cohort, Tom Brady, are the storyline. And that's my wife, who doesn't watch football. She doesn't like it. She doesn't watch the Bears. She doesn't care. And she looked and goes, this guy again? And I mean, even like sitcoms recognize after 10 years, they got to add a baby or a dog, right?
Do something
else. Something else.
Cousin Oliver.
Yeah, they can't have. Receiver. Yeah, they can't have the same guy. I mean, there's. I understand it's sports, and I God love the Patriots for being such a outstanding, upstanding organization to continue to win at football. But there is something to be said about. I think that storyline is played out.
Yeah.
And I don't mean it from a sports standpoint. I mean it from an entertainment standpoint. Nobody wants to watch Tom Brady anymore. Because what comes with that is nonstop ESPN reports about Brady getting older, Budweiser, Tom Jenkins has his report. You know, and you're just constantly having to deal with New England commercials.
Yep.
And Gronkowski getting shoved into the commuter commercial and Brady and I don't know, there's a point where you're like, we need new blood. So in some way, I guess that plays into my understanding that maybe people want the Minnesota Vikings outside of Chicago. Maybe they do want a new blood. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a thing that happens with winners. You do get winner fatigue. You know, you're sick of seeing the same things over and over. Like today, I was on Twitter, and, you know, the big story about how, you know, kids are eating Tide laundry things, apparently. The thing.
Right.
Tide tweeted out, it's like a Rob Gronkowski video of him, like, doing something, like, don't eat Tide laundry pods. I'm like, this now I got to see another New England Patriots.
They're doing PA.
Like a PSA.
Public service announcement.
Here's the good news.
What's the good news?
How old is Brady now? He's in his 40s,
42,
right?
42 or yeah. Something like that, yeah.
Good. Yeah. Maybe one more season. If he is really smart, he might just decide, you know what, win, lose, or draw. This is it. I'm done.
Yeah, you hope that's the case.
Now,
he's got the doctor that's going to have him play till like he's 70.
I don't think so. If his wife is smarter than he is, she will look at him and go, "Honey, love you dearly. You made your money. I don't want to take care of a doddering wahoo."
Do you watch football, David?
Some. I do.
Are you sick and tired of beyond, you know, the sport, but are you tired of the storyline of Bill Belichick and Tom Brady? Like, does it keep you from? Are you excited when the Patriots play? Are you like, oh, it's going to be great football? Or you're just like, oh, these guys again.
As a former New York Yankees fan and a former New York former New York Yankees fan, I'll stick with that. There was the dynasty period where it was George and Billy and Reggie and who was the right hand reliever.
Goose Gossage.
Yeah, the Goose.
Fidrich. I don't know.
You know, Ron Guidry. Willie Randolph.
Yeah, keep going.
Chris Chambliss.
Those guys.
Greg Nettles.
And that was fine because I was a New Yorker at the time still.
You liked it.
And I liked the Yankees.
Yeah.
No problem. However, there's something different about Belichick, Brady, Gronkowski. Because you didn't see a commercial with every one of those guys in the Yankees
time. Right.
Dynasty era in front of you in a TV commercial or a mattress commercial. And it's like, now it's sort of like, okay, look, you guys have had your run. Take a breather.
Yeah.
Take a chill pill.
I agree. I just wonder if that...
Make some room for someone else to have some fun.
The ratings as well, because people who are maybe on the fence or aren't necessarily, you know, hardcore football fans, if they see those guys and are like, enough. And then they're in your politics, and then they're in their... Now, and then there's the breaking news story that they don't really get along, like we care. I don't know. It's just at a certain point, I wonder at the premise, my wife's premise, which I thought was outstanding... was maybe it's just the fact that it's Saturday night and it's in January and the camera is glued to Bill Belichick's dumb hoodie. You know, yeah. He couldn't even dress up for the part. And
he never dresses up.
I think that's my wife's point. It's like there's not even effort in this.
I don't think most coaches really get dressed up.
I want the Tom Landry.
I mean, Tom Landry and Don Shula were truly old school.
Yeah, but Lovie Smith
Shula was a little more
nice
casual, but Landry was the hat, shirt and tie, sports jacket.
John Fox, I mean, just great khakis. really, really baggy. Real strong show.
Yeah, but John Fox wasn't in that category of coach. No, at least not with the Bears.
So this Sunday you got the championship game, Jacksonville and Minnesota win. Jacksonville plays the Vikings in the Super Bowl. People are going to watch it because it's the Super Bowl. Do more people watch it because of the Patriots? Because you get a lot more passive fans. They know actually who knows Tom Brady.
I think more people might watch it because it's not one of the same regulars who's been there. How many years are they in a row have they been, have made the finals?
They talked about them playing in the last 7 AFC championship games. The Patriots have been in the last 7 AFC championship games. They've won some, they've lost some. The Steelers beat them, the Broncos beat them. Last 7. Can you imagine? Chicago Bears fans, can you imagine? All right, let's take a quick break. Stay with us. Always good to get a home invasion story in. Those stories always top the news, right? I love it. There's a lot of them lately. I've noticed. I was reading this. They're doing stuff for the carryout, and there were like 5 of them on the Sun-Times and Tribune about petty theft and crime like that. That seems to be a go-to. I'm not saying that that's reflective that there's more crime. It just means what newspapers are reporting on. Yeah. At least they're over last week's grandiose, I'm going to say what the president said. Because I can. It's the media now, and I'm going to say what he said. And I don't know if you saw SNL this weekend. It was just constant with the bad words. I know that the host messed up and dropped
Sam
the F word,
mm-hmm.
which you're like,
he won't be coming back.
Yeah, and I guess it's not even an issue anymore. It's like everything within the Trump era that used to be the biggest story in the world. If somebody did that, that would tarnish their career, and it would be the number one story, and it doesn't even make didn't even rippled up. But they were giddy in how far they could go with the FCC. They just were going as to the wall as possible. Even in the news, they were making fun of the censors said they couldn't say it, but the president can. Uh-huh. And the only problem I had with that, and I said in the carryout, and I trust me, I'm again, as I made it very clear in the carryout, what he said was wrong. But he didn't actually say the word in public. He said it closed door. Many presidents have done that. As Chris Roebling said, many presidents have done that and they haven't gotten caught. Right? And that, there's something to be said about that. That's about the understand who's in the room, president. But for media and for SNL and for everyone to then feel like they have carte blanche because the president said it, this was a source. This wasn't the president actually saying it to the public. So to me, the jump to being able to say that because the president said it doesn't work. So when CNN or the news or SNL or any or the late night talk shows say it, I feel like they're out of bounds. I know I sound very conservative in that regard, but feel like they're out of bounds because the president didn't actually say it on the record. It's being sourced that he said it. So it seems weird that they're pushing the boundaries of it. That's just my thought on it.
Well, watching the cable coverage,
right?
They were dropping it everywhere.
They're still doing it. They're still doing
it. Well, they can. They're not over-the-air television.
Well, I guess they can. They just
They're cable.
Did they not use those words because of decency, not because
generally,
of regulation?
Generally speaking, it's left up to them. The FCC really doesn't have any authority over words coming out on cable television because it's not over-the-air. Over the air? Yeah, I don't think anyone at a local station said that four-letter word.
Right.
Because that would be a problem.
Well,
because it's one of George Carlin's heavy seven.
But SNL went, they had everything in there. They were using when you add, it was funny because when Sam Rockwell adds the slip up to use the F word, then it compounds the problem that every sketch that they have on that show has not the F word, but a word. I mean, they're using all sorts of words in their parody of Stanley Tucci. They're you know what, the Stanley Tucci rap they did? That was like, they used 5 or 6 words that 10 years ago they couldn't use on TV. The same with, it was funny because even the shockingness of the news of the Weekend Update to say the words that they said was less because Rockwell dropped the F-bomb three sketches before. I just felt it to be kind of undisciplined.
Well, look,
by that show, I just felt like at the end of the day, I love my comedy with swear words, no doubt about it. I love it.
I remember Monty Python back in the day when it aired, when I was living in New York, it aired on the local PBS station, and I was stunned when I noticed, oh my God, it's a guy and he's standing there naked, fully, full frontal, all right? And this, Europe has a whole, they're far more relaxed about it.
Yeah.
They don't freak out. They don't act like, ooh, you can't say those words.
Yeah,
we're a little bit stupid,
yeah, we're
frankly.
Immature about it. It's a little juvenile, I thought. And then Texter said the same thing. And CNN 773 says, CNN especially acting like third graders learning a swear word on the playground. It's the same concept. There is that vibe to it. SNL, too. Like, how dangerous are we? And I was like, you've been dangerous. That's been your shtick for 40 years. You've been dangerous. You say the things, but it's not that dangerous to say these words. And I'd rather see you do something that's more satirical or take on what's happening as opposed to, I don't know. Did you notice? Did you watch it, Pete? Did you watch it, Sarah?
I didn't. I guess I didn't really notice that. I mean, I saw Sam Rockwell. I just thought.
I'm just a dad now. I was just like, maybe feel like everything's old, gold, geez.
Well, we watched it on Sunday, and like you're seeing on Sunday morning, you see everybody talk, oh, how great, you know, the Steve Bannon and Bill Murray. And I was like, it was kind of a bad show. I liked Keenan doing LeVar Ball's
yeah,
dad.
That was
like,
so
the,
funny.
Like the best.
That's so funny.
Like, forget about
that. He had a line in there that was so funny. I forgot what it was. Never eat the cabbage or something like that. I honestly say Kenan Thompson, and I digress, not the conversation, but top five cast members of all time. Discuss.
He's great. And the political stuff, that first sketch I didn't think with Fred Armisen doing Michael Wolff, I didn't think was great. I didn't think the news was that great. I like the My Drunk Boyfriend.
You know who was really great at the news desk? And I hate to say it because he's kind of gone to the dark side politically, Dennis Miller.
Yeah, he was great. He was great. I don't even mind that his politics are what they are. He was funny in that. I was surprised in watching a Weekend Update. I think it was at the SNL exhibit. They had like a Weekend Update kind of vibe, like room or TV thing or whatever, and he didn't get much play. I was surprised he was almost omitted. You know, they've got they spent a lot on Seth Meyers and a lot on Tina Fey. But I was like, yeah, there was the Tina Fey and Jimmy Fallon, and then there was the Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. Anyway,
what about Colin Quinn?
Dennis
Colin
Miller.
Quinn get any?
Not as much as Norm Macdonald. No.
Who did the sort of gender neutral
Pat?
Pat. Yeah. Who did that?
Julia Sweeney.
Yeah.
And David, I didn't even ask you for that, tie-in.
She's another one that...
She is my guest tomorrow night.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, she's my guest at the big table. Talk about, she got a show coming up at Second City. There you go. Look at that synergy. That was great. All right, we'll take a quick break here. We'll come back. We'll get the news. And then Squirrel Nut Zipper, stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're coming up on the 16th Space in Evanston. We'll be swinging to the music of the Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Serious strike. Now you make the scene all day, but tomorrow they'll be held to pay. The people listen attentively. I mean about future calamity. I used to think the idea was obsolete until I heard the old man stamping his feet. Eternally, fire is
is applied to their body. Teeth are extruded and burnt aground and baked into cakes which are passed around.
Squirrel Nut Zippers came to be in Chapel Hill, North Carolina back in the mid-90s. The band brought about a revival of swing jazz with their distinct jazz, calypso, klezmer-like sound, very distinct, and some say they recreated a movement. Their second album, Hot, actually crossed over to the airwaves with the hit song Hell, which we just heard above. A new configuration of the band just toured to celebrate that album's 20th anniversary. The guitarist and singer Jimbo Mathis put together a mix of old and new members and continues to tour, including an upcoming gig at Space. And a new music is on the way. Joining me tonight, Jimbo Mathis from the Squirrel Nut Zippers. Jimbo, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Good to see you and talk to you, Mr. Justin. How are you?
I'm good. I was a big fan of that record, and it's great to talk to you. It's amazing to think it's been, you know, over 20 years since that album came out. But talk about, you know, touring it the year before and also the recollections that come about touring an album 20 years after the fact.
Well, I mean, I was just, we were part of a mad creative process, you know, when that whole thing was getting put together. Really in isolation, you know, and just really juiced on, like, early American music and the roots of what is American music, you know, and what is presenting American music, you know, entertaining people. And that's a big question, you know, and we went about answering it, you know. Upon reflecting on it, you know, I realized it was really quite a cool body of work that I had masterminded, and it really shouldn't sit on the shelves, you know. It should be out there doing its job, which is just kind of intriguing people, entertaining people, mesmerizing people, and creating joy, you know.
Yeah.
I went about putting the thing back together, you know.
It's amazing, too. I say at the top it's swing jazz, but it's more than that. You said it in an article I was just reading about. It's almost like a vaudeville punk rock band. Talk about how do you see Squirrel Nut Zippers and how it relates to that throwback swing jazz movement that was happening back in the 90s?
Like I said, Justin, I mean, we operated in total isolation, so we were just really juiced on understanding what made music work, what made early American music jive and swing and do its thing. So we looked into things like calypso and all the Latin music that influenced American music, and of course, Tin Pan Alley jazz, New Orleans jazz, vaudeville. I mean, it's just such an endless subject you could never tap the well. So we were completely caught off guard when our sound took off and became a part of an era. We really never planned that.
It is something to be said. I mean, it's amazing to think that it's not just music, because rarely did swing jazz cross over and get into the airwaves or even part of an alternative music movement. But it did in the 90s, and it was happening here in Chicago and other places. But also with you, it was more than just the music. It was cultural. It was what people were dressing. Everything about it, there was really a throwback to something from the 30s.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just taps into that, as Bob Dylan said, that old weird America. And, you know, when we first, one of the first times we played in Chicago was at the Green Mill, which was at an incredibly historic venue. I don't know if I can say that on air,
yeah,
but
yeah. I love that place.
It was a legacy. It was a part of the link in the chain of history, you know, of music and a town, you know, like Chicago. Just unbelievable things like that really made the Zippers cool, you know, that we continue to be able to play in the historic places and forge another link in the chain, you know, with real vaudeville entertainment with some heavy undertones to it. You know, it's not just fluff. And with the new orchestra I have, it's so well done. It's really unbelievable. The music gets a whole new life.
I read that you started playing music when you were young. I mean, you're 6 years old, something like that. When you started Squirrel Nut Zippers, how much of getting into calypso music or hot jazz or klezmer was new to you? Or how much of it was actually ingrained in you as a young boy?
Well, I grew up in folk tradition, you know, so I'm from Mississippi. I continue to reside in Mississippi. And so I grew up in a family of musicians, so it was a folk idiom, you know. It was blues, it was gospel country. And but yes, I was a folklorist, musicologist, and so it was all very new to me, the whole bigger picture, because I grew up in a very impoverished area, very, you know, scholastically inept. you might could say. And so when I moved to Chapel Hill, I was very juiced on the libraries, the music that was available, the folklore program at the college, that I could go and listen to records and try to figure out, find Library of Congress files on lyrics and, you know, just a wealth of information. So it was all very new to me. That part of American culture was very new to me. Now, the actual real social music I grew up with.
On the line with me tonight, Jimbo Mathis. He, of course, is the singer guitar player for Squirrel Nut Zippers, a band that has been around now for 25 years. Just celebrated its 20th anniversary of their album Hot and their track Hell, which crossed over and was played in alternative music back in the 90s. As I mentioned, you brought the whole new orchestra together, and you have an old and a new mix here. How different is the process of the Squirrel Nut Zippers when you're working with new people, yet it's the same foundation, the same type of music?
It's really interesting because a lot of the cats in the band, like I'm rather old. I mean, I'm 50 years old now. And so a lot of the cats in the band were actually heard the Zippers music coming up and inspired them to go into things like burlesque or jazz music or New Orleans jazz, so it was like-minded people that I had sort of curated and met over the time. I've been very active in music over this entire interim. It was interesting and I really enjoyed it, and I mean the band I have now they're just stellar entertainers, artists, and very, very concerned about presenting this music with the respect, with the fresh energy, you know, fresh approach and fresh talent. Oh, my God, the talent is over the moon, you know, so I couldn't be more thrilled.
Chicago has such a rich history of jazz and blues and folk. There's so many things, so many bands and artists that come through
Indeed.
Here and continue to come through, not unlike Squirrel Nut Zippers at the Space coming up here. But back in the 90s, when we talk about that album 20 years ago, 22 years now, Hot, you were crossing over to an alternative music mainstream, to playing in front of 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds and people who are maybe not familiar with the roots of this music or the history of this music, but were there in the moment because you were opening up for, or a band was opening up for you guys that was on the radio. Talk about the difference in playing this kind of music to people who are familiar with its history and its roots, and playing this kind of music when it's the hot thing at the time.
Well, I mean, it was obviously more chaotic then and just more unexpected. I mean, we never expected to be playing with Morphine and with right. Neil Young and playing, you know, on Sesame Street and all of the things we did, you know, and playing for tens of thousands of people. It was pure energy. Now we've had time to reflect on and actually comprehend what it is that we did, and just kind of go with it and make it a new thing. But at the time, I mean, it's a world of difference. You know, I appreciate it now, appreciated it then, but now it's just a more mellow feeling and just saying, hey, man, we really did something cool.
I know you got a new album coming out soon. Talk about that. Talk about how the music, when you're putting something out, how does it differ than the music that we're talking about today in the mid-90s and 2000s? What's the big difference?
I don't think there is any, you know. I mean, it's still the same band that's out rampaging the territory, you know, and just, we always wrote about things that are happening, current events to us. I mean, it was disguised in black humor, parody. So, you know, just being out there on the road again, seeing how the music is causing reactions and bringing people to the concerts. And it was easy to write a new record, you know, and it was easy to get back to that same space. So it's really been fun, and the new record is incredible. It's called Beasts of Burgundy, and it's all original music, and it's really just in that same era of vaudeville, swing, hot jazz, calypso, just that weird old America.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I love the Squirrel Nut Zippers, too. You guys, longtime fan of yours, and it's great to hear you back. Jimbo Mathis on the line tonight. I can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk with us. Good luck with the new album, and good luck with the show at Space.
Mr. Justin and all your listeners, I appreciate y'all, man. I look forward to seeing you there.
When I was a lad, I was a little bit shy. Something came along, caught my eye. When I heard the jazz band strike up, I swear I had my mind made up. Now I'm getting older, and everything is in full swing. Now I'm getting bolder. My boy got to do that thing.
something, darling, you got a little something new, got a little something new, broke away somehow, that's why I'm swinging it, got my own thing now.
Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Nice to have Jimbo on the show. Yeah, it's funny because the squirrel nut zippers, and doing a lot of research in this area for the interview and also talking to Jimbo, it was amazing to think that they were part of, if not the impetus, but part of a movement to bring not just the music, the swing jazz, the hot jazz, he had a couple other things. Hot tin top jazz, calypso, klezmer, whatever it is, but to bring that back, you know, to know. And I remember that, I was thinking about that because, you know, obviously the Green Mill is mentioned, and the Mighty Blue Kings. I think it was like on a Thursday night you would go up to see them, or Tuesday night, Mighty Blue Kings at the Green Mill, and you'd try to squeeze in, get in there shoulder to shoulder to watch the swing jazz band play at the Green. That was amazing. That was a high time, and I was happy to be in my 20s at that time, right? It's 20 years ago. And you would never actually go to that show. You just bragged that you knew about that show. You know, the Mighty Blue Kings. You'd be like, the Mighty Blue Kings, yeah. Oh, maybe you'd throw it. That was before Twitter, so you couldn't brag like you were doing something even though you weren't doing it. You had to do that in person to person. Like on your landline. Now I can go on Twitter right now and be like, oh, Mighty Blue Kings, best band ever. Love them on Tuesday nights, even though I didn't go.
And back then, you could also go to the nearest payphone and call someone to tell them.
Exactly.
Find a payphone now.
I saw one not too long ago. There was one in a bar. It was like in a bar in Ukrainian village. I could say right now, Mighty Blue Kings, Tuesday night. Oh, love these guys. And everyone would think I'm there. Maybe if I did go one time, I would snap a picture and then use it every time. Just keep using the same photo. Back then, I'd have to call and casually work it into a conversation. Hey, hi, is Jenny home? Oh, is this a roommate? Hi, Jenny. What are you doing tonight? Are you going to the Mighty Blue Kings? I love the Mighty Blue Kings. That's how I talked in my 20s. I go there all the time. You do? Yeah. But that was a big thing. And Martyrs had a rockabilly. It kind of morphed into rockabilly. I feel like the swing jazz, and then they started doing the swing jazz outfits, almost like the country the country shirts.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever Lawrence Peters comes in, he's got the country shirt on.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it morphed into, that was it. That was like the swingers kind of vibe.
Right. I felt it started with swingers, the popularity with the movie Swingers, because they were into the, you know,
they were
big bad voodoo daddy, and they would go out and they went out to that swing club.
Right.
Next thing you know.
Do you think that the popularity of that music and that style and that culture came from swingers, or was swingers successful because of the popularity?
I think swingers was the impetus for the success, if that's a good sentence.
Strong. Put that in the documentary. Yeah, but you can make an argument that they were just doing a movie on a scene that was hot, right? I mean, they were...
Yeah, maybe. Like in L.A., it was already a thing.
And same as Chicago.
By the time you got to Chicago, it was...
Maybe we were a little later.
Yeah.
When was Swingers? Was that would have been like
96 or something like that?
Right in there.
I feel that the zippers, as we like to call them, were kind of caught up in that move. They were at the right place at the right time.
Yeah. And I knew them, and they kind of referenced it in their bio as well. They're big. They were used a lot in NPR bumpers. So, you know, like that music.
Yeah.
Welcome back to NPR. And that's how I knew them, because I worked at the NPR affiliate here.
Yeah.
And so I always knew that music, and I knew they were and I didn't recognize that they were a Letterman band. Like, when we started doing the research on this, there was a ton of appearances on Letterman. Letterman loved them. Returning now, the Squirrel Nut Zippers, like that kind of thing. I didn't recognize they were at that level where they were actually getting, even into the 2000s, they were getting regular play on the late night talk shows.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Did Letterman ask the drummer if those drums are his or rented?
That's love my that favorite bit. If you go find the YouTube clip of Letterman drums, just put in Letterman drums, and someone put together all the times that David Letterman actually called out, are those drums yours? Like when he comes over to greet the band? That's the best. And you don't even recognize it in the moment, but all called together.
Yeah.
And they said it because he's a drummer, right? Or he was a drummer in his life? I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, so the Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Yeah, great.
Doing two shows up at Space coming up tomorrow.
Man, great place to see them, I would imagine.
Yeah. I didn't really get into it, but there's lineup changes like crazy. The band, if you were a Squirrel Nut Zippers fan in the 20 years ago, I think it's only two of the five that are left. Like, they've had some falling out and some changes, and I don't even know what's falling out. I think there was a divorce in there. But they've changed lineups. They've all reunited, and then but this iteration that's out is mostly, I think it's just Jimbo and the drummer. And then the others have filled in different parts. But they've been touring in this kind of way for a while. Sports Boyfriend coming up at Studio 435. I'm very excited. Eileen Peltier in studio. This is going to be great. Setting up. Bob's setting up. She's going to be here. We'll talk to her about her young career, and we'll get some live music. That's straight away here in the 10 o'clock hour. Stay with us. Thanks, David. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. Last week, tenor Roderick Dixon was here singing Handel, a little Les Mis. Before that, we brought you the old-timey country of Big Sadie. You can go to our website at WGNradio.com and search Studio 435 to find all of the great performances that we've had. Studio 435 tonight, we go indie pop. Eileen Peltier is here. She's a solo artist known to the world as Sports Boyfriend. She's been getting great reviews for her work over the past couple years, and she just released a new single called I Only Leave My House to Dance With You. She's going to be at Shuba's on Wednesday night as part of the Tomorrow Never Knows Festival. Shuba's, of course, at Belmont and Southport, right there in Lakeview. Sports Boyfriend Eileen Peltier in studio tonight. Eileen, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm a fan of your music. I loved it. I love everything. I'm looking forward to the performance tonight.
Thank you.
So let's start. I mean, this is a big deal to play Tomorrow Never Knows. This is a big festival that comes through Chicago, and they've had a good run at it. What's it mean for you to get up on stage at Shuba's and be a part of it?
Oh, yeah, I'm really excited. I mean, I've seen a lot of artists that I really like at Shuba's, so it's always nice to be able to play there and kind of be on the same stage. Yeah, they're doing a really great job with that. I love all the people that I get to play with on Wednesday.
For you, and I have so many questions about the music because it's you. I mean, you're in studio, and when you hear the sound, you know, through my headphones and listening all day today and waking up the neighbors, you feel it's a robust sound. It feels like a full band, but here in studio, it's you and your computer and your guitar. But the point being that you are a solo artist, and you like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I do everything at home. It just seemed to be the easiest way when I first started out, and now I don't really know how to do it anyway else. But yeah, that's just kind of how I got started, like working off my computer. And then I've sort of added a little bit more when I do like bigger live shows, but I still kind of do everything recorded by myself still in my house.
There's one thing to record and produce the music at home, but it's another to mix the music and be able to put it on stage. Talk about the differences, because there's going to be reading about you and you know, your DePaul dorm room sort of at the beginning of your musical career, to being able to take what you're doing in the isolated space of your room and be able to put it on stage at Shuba's.
Oh yeah, there's definitely been a lot of like playing live has definitely influenced the way that I work at home a lot. Just some things that sound better at home just don't translate as well to like a live stage. And I played like a lot of, you know, smaller like basement shows and kind of worked through some of that stuff and sort of figured out what works and what doesn't, like what needs to be changed when I move something over to live. It's just like, things just sound very different when you're listening to them alone.
Do you find yourself, because you have a pretty small canon of work, 17 to 20 songs or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, do you find yourself saying, this song's just not going to work live?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of older songs that I have that, like, I really love them, but just, like, the way, like, sort of the energy of a live show, I think they would work better almost in, like, you know, like a DJ set or something. But, like, just with, like, the way sort of live shows in Chicago are working right now, it just, like, doesn't make a lot of sense to do it live. It's like, I love having it on the internet and people can kind of see that I do like to do different things, but I've noticed that sort of a more, you know, a little more upbeat, something I can use a guitar a little bit more in, just sort of engages the crowd.
Yeah, so better. A lot of it is about engagement. A lot of it is how you can interact in a moment with the crowd in the space. Even if you have a song that you love and you're passionate about and it sounds great, it may not be the right vibe for people who are standing there with a beer in hand.
Oh, yeah, totally. And also just, you know, with a lot of the music in Chicago is a little bit more rock focused. So, you know, the shows you're getting booked for, it's going to be full band. So you have to kind of be not necessarily like competing with that full band sound, but just sort of like working with it.
Are people surprised when you come out and it's Sports Boyfriend and maybe you're opening up for a different band and it's just you and your computer and your guitar? Are they like, that's it? Well,
Yeah. That was definitely, came up a lot when I first started playing. Like, people were like, oh, when's the rest of your band getting here? And I was like, but I have been playing with a bass player. My friend Alex plays bass now live in the shows, and that's definitely made a huge difference as well, because just like people are so receptive to seeing more than one person on stage. It just like makes more sense to people, I think.
Well, how was it for you as a musician working in collaboration with another musician, one that you learned and evolved as a solo artist by yourself? I mean, how is it to have another musician join you on stage?
It's really actually, like, I was nervous about it at first just because I'm not really used to that. I never played in a band before this. I feel like a lot of people, you know, have had multiple projects, but this is kind of the only thing I've done. But it's really comforting to have someone else up there, because if something's going well, you know, you have that, like, energy with them. And if something's going, like, not well, like, it's really nice to have someone to, like, look at on stage instead of just being up there by yourself. Like, it's definitely a lot of pressure to be just by yourself up there.
Well, there's something great about music and performing live, and a lot of people will say that the camaraderie of a band and being able to share that chemistry. I've had a lot of bands in Studio 435 talking about that. It also helps absorb the moments that are awkward, the moments that might be not as fun, like when something's not working. But to be out there by yourself, to put yourself out there for people and have to take the highs and the lows that go with that, that's got to be somewhat challenging.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely not something I would have thought I'd be able to do, like, even a couple years ago. But I had my friend Milo actually asked me to play, like, a house show in his basement once. And that was the first show I ever did. And I kind of said yes on a whim. And it went well enough that I was like, I guess I'll keep doing this. But that was, like, a really scary moment, like, deciding to actually go through with that. Because it's just, like, I had never really thought I would take the work I was doing in my house to, like, an actual event.
What were you thinking? What do you think the output was going to be? Were you thinking this would just be something on SoundCloud people would enjoy, or something just for yourself?
It was kind of just for myself. I mean, like, I would send stuff to my friends, and a lot of the earlier stuff I was making was sort of just like, oh, I like, you know, like this song. I want to make something, see if I can make something that sounds like this. And so it would just kind of, like, it went on the internet almost as just like a little thing that I could use to send to my friends. But, sort of once I figured out how to, like, come up with more of my own sound, like, people started asking if I was going to, like, do shows and, like, put, like, work out, like, more professionally. And I was, like, thought they were joking at first.
you did graduate. Are you graduate at DePaul?
Yeah, I graduated in 2016.
So, I mean, you're relatively new to the music world here in Chicago, and you spent your time in Chicago. You just graduated college. I mean, you didn't go to college necessarily to be a pop star or to be a pop musician in that regard. Is this taking you in different directions that you thought your life would go in? I mean, at such a young age, are you thinking this music and what I do as Sports Boyfriend has got legs and this is what I'm going to do?
It's been really interesting because I never had really, you know, like everyone like would like to have that be something they could do. Like, but I never really thought it was a realistic thing because I just didn't think I would ever be able to do like live shows, and that's such a necessary part of like a career in that now. And you know, it's still tough because it's still really hard to make a living doing that, even if you know you're like doing really, really well. But it definitely wasn't something I was thinking of while I was in school. It's been really interesting. I have like, I work at a restaurant too, and you know, like that's just totally separate. Like it's just a totally separate thing than this. But it's really nice to have like, you know, as something, it's like not really a hobby anymore, but it's also not really a job yet. So it's really cool.
That's that sweet spot. Eileen Peltier in studio. She is the artist known to the world as Sports Boyfriend. She's going to be at Shuba's on Wednesday night as part of the Tomorrow Never Knows Festival. Great festival, which comes through around this time every year. Shuba's, of course, in Lakeview. We will take a quick break here. We'll come back and we'll hear some live music from Sports Boyfriend in Studio 435. Stay with us. Live Studio 435. It's a download here on 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, coming up here, Eileen Peltier. She is the artist known as Sports Boyfriend. She's playing at Shuba's on Wednesday night as part of the Tomorrow Never Knows Festival. Great festival that plays at Shuba's and Lincoln Hall and Hideout and other places all around Chicagoland this week and next. Sports Boyfriend is the band. Eileen Peltier is the artist. And she is going to perform now. Here is the track. That's a novelty on Studio 435. WGN, take it away.
Around, it won't put a roof over your head. Ooh, it's sure gonna help you build a wall, saturate your world with dread. And every time I talk to you, every single word I've said, ooh, I don't know what I'm looking for, rooting around your head. Novelty, the only word that means something to me. The second time I look at you is the last time I see. Nothing to build a life around.
Yeah, there we go. Eileen Peltier as Sports Boyfriend in Studio 435. That's the track Novelty. Here she is playing at the Tomorrow Never Knows Festival, which is coming up here on Wednesday at Shuba's. Eileen, you come on back to the table. There you go. Yeah, she's playing Shuba's Tomorrow Never Knows Festival. This will be on Wednesday night. Shuba's, of course, in Lakeview, both at, or at Belmont and Southport in Lakeview. Eileen, I'm fascinated in where you derive your inspiration for that, because the music, the guitar, the vocals, the beat, of course, they all come together. I love the stuff, but they all do feel like they come from different inspirations. Talk about the music that inspires you as an artist.
So for like a song like that, I mean, I definitely got a lot of my like for like drums especially, I take a lot of inspiration from more like electronic music, I would say. It's just easier to work with when you are working on the computer. Yeah, it's really hard to get like a very like natural, like shuffly sound, when you're programming drums. But the guitar, I would definitely say, is a little bit more like almost like a classic rock style. Like most of the, you know, chord progressions I'm using and like scales and stuff I'm taking things from are like blues based. And a lot of the guitar on top of it is just like, I try to improvise it every time that I play.
Really?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's all, like, scales and stuff, but I try to kind of, like, it changes the feeling of the song every time, because I can't really repeat it, because I don't really remember what I'm doing every time, so I just try to, like, make up something new every time I play the song.
As every good blues musician does, right?
Well, there is something, I mean, where does that style come from for you? I mean, did you learn scales and music in that form when you were growing up and learning guitar?
Yeah, I would say definitely. I mean, a lot of the artists I was listening to were kind of playing guitar along those lines, like especially somebody like, I don't know, like Jack White from the White Stripes definitely mm-hmm. was playing kind of in that style, and that was what I was really interested in high school, was like music like that. So that definitely affected sort of the way I learned how to play guitar. And I think that I don't know, just like when I would write naturally on top of drums, that was sort of just what would happen. So,
well, even the melody and being able to put the vocals on top of the stuff, I mean, it is a very advanced sound. I mean, and I'm not saying that it shouldn't be, but I'm saying, you know, it's not your normal kind of pop song where you would have a set and here would come the chorus and here would come the refrain. All that kind of stuff is kind of thrown out the window, and that's what makes it great. Like when listening to it today, there's something great about your approach to this music. Do you think about how you phrase things and approach the vocals when it comes to the music that you're producing?
Oh yeah, definitely. I take a lot of songwriting cues from pretty traditional like pop and country music, I would say, because I just really enjoy sort of the narrative quality a lot of those songs have, so they're like relatable to everyone while also being like sort of specific in the way that you're singing them, you know. And I also kind of enjoy songs that I can, you know, if I'm in a really great mood, can kind of make happy when I sing them, or, you know, bring them down too. Like it's definitely like, I wouldn't say the lyrics are necessarily ever happy or sad, it's just kind of like the attitude that you come at them with,
right?
And that's always kind of the most interesting music to me.
The music, it's kind of, I guess you call it indie pop, lo-fi, maybe electronic in there as well. I mean, is there, when I think about that, and you mentioned a little bit earlier the fact that you're always getting bunched in with rock groups that'll go on stage at a Shuba's, so you'll be the one person up there. Like, I'm not the six-piece, I'm Eileen. Is there a community around this kind of music? I mean, I feel like there is. I feel like there are a lot of artists who are working this way and that might be coming up at the same time in Chicago. Is there a community around this kind of music?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is. I think it's just a little bit smaller still than, like, you know, especially the more traditional, like, you know, garage indie rock scene in Chicago, which is just, like, you know, super established, and it's pretty... you know, there's kind of like a path you can take if you want to start doing music like that.
Right.
Which is awesome because it makes it easier for different kind of voices to get in there. But I would say it's probably a little smaller for like particularly like that combination. But there's definitely like a huge dance music scene in Chicago. You know, there's a huge hip hop scene in Chicago. So people are making like electronic music, obviously.
Right.
I I think the crossover is going to be really interesting because I think there will be more crossover between those kind of
communities. Yeah, I wonder. I wonder when more people are exposed, especially in the rock and indie and punk rock areas, are exposed to this kind of music. There seems to be a lot of similarities, but at the same time, a lot of ways that that music can expand into the things that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, and there's also, you know, there's always stuff that like a band can do that I can't do, you know, like sort of. It would be really cool to be able to improvise live more with like other art, like musicians and stuff. But I mean, so, and that's what those bands do get to have. But you know, hopefully that I can kind of draw from them as well.
Well, you're the 2018 version of the guy who has to put the cymbals on his knees.
Oh, I know. I was thinking about that.
I've been around long enough where that guy comes through in the show and he'll be like, all right, you can play the drums with the bottom parts of your legs and you can play the bass with your elbow. Like, there's a lot going on. But I like the way you do it.
I know. I sometimes do the one-man band. I'm like, oh, my God.
The one-man band Eileen Peltier in studio thing. She's known as Sports Boyfriend, and she is playing Shubas on Wednesday night as part of the Tomorrow Never Knows Festival, Shubas in Lakeview. Sports Boyfriend in studio 435 tonight. We'll continue. When we come back, we'll hear some more live music. Thanks, David. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it's Studio 435, our weekly showcase. Best live music Chicago has to offer in our Allstate Showcase Studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, Eileen Peltier is here. She is the artist known as Sports Boyfriend. She's going to be at Shubas on Wednesday night for the Tomorrow Never Knows Festival. Shubas in Lakeview. She is in studio tonight. We'll talk more with her. But first, let's get another live performance. Here she is, their latest single, I Only Leave My House to Dance With You. Take it away, Sports Boyfriend.
What you're trying to do? What you're trying to do with me? I don't have time for you. House to dance with you. I only leave my house to dance with you. I only leave my house to dance with you. It's what I need.
Thank you.
Keep it going. Yeah. Eileen Peltier is sports boyfriend. She's playing at Chubas at Tomorrow Never Knows Festival coming up on Wednesday night. The festival, which is a big deal, which is in town for a couple weeks here. Eileen Peltier in studio. That's the single. I love that song. I love it. That's the one that hooked me today.
Oh, thank
I played
you.
It over and over. And there, it's very, I mean, there's something great. And to watch you perform it live is to watch you take advantage of the skills that you have on your laptop. And what I mean by that is that you're able to loop some stuff. You're able to use the beat. You're able to play off of it as if it is another musician, and that's a skill. I mean, because there's a different thing. People might say, oh, you're just hitting the space bar and the drum kit or the drum beat starts, but you're doing much more in there. It's much more complicated than it seems.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely I think there are parts of it that are a little bit harder than working with a live band, because you know, if you lose your spot, it's just kind of that's it. Like, you know, you can't really like it's, or I mean, you could, but it would be a lot of work to go back and like kind of retread your steps. Like with a live band, you do have a little bit more flexibility if something like that happens. There's definitely like a huge benefit to being able to do a lot of it on the computer, because they don't have to be as reliant on like everyone else, like, you know,
yeah,
doing their part right every time. But you know, if something goes wrong with
but
the computer.
But I'm assuming in the evolution of your career as a musician from the times being in the dorm room at DePaul to where you're at now, still working in your house, working on your laptop, that you have developed more skills in this area. You're a better sound editor. You're probably a better beat maker.
Learn
all the tools that people don't even think about this, the tools that can make your music better, but still are not unlike learning how to play a better guitar or a better drum kit. You're able to master what you're doing with your computer.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, like, as with anything, when you first start out doing that, you know, it's not going to sound very good, and you just have to keep kind of making things. And it's I would say the most important part of that for me was like learning how to do that was just like listening to a ton of music, but like really, you know, in a very active way. So, you know, always kind of thinking about what someone might be doing when they're engineering work, or like how they're recording something that makes it sound the way that I like.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's definitely come like a really long way.
It becomes a skill, especially in pop music, because you're seeing more and more bands that are accompanied by a DJ, or maybe, and I don't mean to single out artists, but like a Justin Bieber is with a DJ. He's with a DJ now, as opposed to just him. He's got Skrillex or someone else who's
yeah.
on. But there seems to be more of an emphasis put on producers, DJs, and musicians who have more skill with electronic music and with their computer.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think like for popular music especially, it seems to be kind of the evolution. It's sort of where, I mean, in experimental music too, that's kind of the most that's sort of like where the cutting edge work is being done, I think, in a lot of places. And yeah, definitely it's been really interesting watching the last probably like, I guess probably 6 or 7 years, like just producers kind of getting a spotlight role,
right,
which is just really surprising, because you know, path before that, no one really ever cared
yeah
about.
Absolutely. It's funny, I have a very dorky moment, and I reveal my age at 43, that I was watching the Ninjago movie cartoon.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
I have a 10-year-old son, and at the end they play a song, just like with the Batman Lego music, there's a song, and you're just like, it's just at you, and you know, it's just a pop song that repeats the movie's plot line, right? And I was like, I was so fascinated by it that I went down the rabbit hole to find out more.
Oh yeah.
And it's a producer. It's not even a musician. It's not somebody who's a band or an artist. It's just a producer
yeah.
who put the whole thing together and used another singer and all this kind of
yeah.
And it reminded me of, yeah, these are producers. This isn't even necessarily a band trying to make their big break on a soundtrack.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's just like a whole different kind of like vibe for everybody when you're working like that instead of like in a band. I mean, there's great things about both of them. And I mean, especially now, you know, the way that a lot of pop musicians are working, you know, they're not like playing instruments anyway. And they don't really have to. That's not sort of what they're supposed to be
right.
good at. So like to have somebody else who can just kind of work with them in a studio and hear what their strengths would be and like build something around that.
As an artist, as a musician, as someone who has come up in the last couple of years as someone who is isolated in the sense that you choose to work by yourself, and but you're changing with the bass player on stage, are you open to producing other music, to producing other people's music, being in a position where you could use the skills that you've commandeered with your laptop to collaborate with other musicians?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, a big part of what I like to do is kind of work with people who, for whatever reason, like wouldn't really be recording something in a studio, whether they don't, you know, have the funds for that, or they don't have the time, or, you know, they don't feel like their work is like, you know, professional sounding enough or whatever, like sort of trying to work more with them in this kind of like apartment studio that I have now, where it's like, you know, obviously it's not going to sound like a, you know, like perfect studio space, but it still sounds pretty good. And like, I think for a lot of people, like that's what you need right now. You know, it's like, it's, I just like to be as encouraging as possible to people whose music I like and be like, really like helpful to them in any way that I can with that.
Well, I always think about when people say it's not a professional studio, I always think about the bands of the 90s that were big, like the Veruca Salts or the Smashing Pumpkins. And I think it was Veruca Salt was in the studio one time talking about the studio they had, which was in Wicker Park and essentially under the L.
Yeah.
Like, so there was like, there's a lot of outside noise that they couldn't handle. But yeah, so I would think that there's still, there's professional as a wide variety.
Yeah, yeah. And I also feel like it's just kind of this barrier people put in their minds to be like, oh, like I can't make something, you know, right, that other people right. want to listen to, because I can't like afford to get a, like a full studio space. Like, you don't really need it anymore for that.
Eileen Peltier is in studio with me. She is known to the world as Sports Boyfriend. A texter wanted to know where you came up with that name, Sports Boyfriend.
Oh, my sister came up with it. She was making fun of me because I was wearing like one of those varsity jacket things that was really popular a couple years ago. She's like, where'd you get that? A Sports Boyfriend? Did you get one of those?
Well, there you go. There's the origin story. We did it quick. Eileen Peltier is Sports Boyfriend. She's playing at Shuba's on Wednesday as part of the Tomorrow Never Knows Festival. In studio, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get a last live performance from Sports Boyfriend. Stay with us. It's the Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Studio 435, in full effect right now as Eileen Peltier is in studio. She is known to the world as Sports Boyfriend. She will be at Shuba's on Wednesday night as part of the Tomorrow Never Knows Festival. Shuba's, of course, Belmont and Southport and Lakeview. You can find out all of her stuff is online, Sports Boyfriend's Bandcamp. You can get it all on iTunes and places that she releases singles. Her latest single, which was just released at the end of 2017, is I Only Leave My House to Dance With You, which we just heard. The single before that was Jasmine in the Summer, which is what we're going to hear next here to wrap up Studio 435. Eileen Peltier, known as Sports Boyfriend, take it away.
broke myself apart every day. No, I couldn't break apart in a moment. Every time that I look the other way. And when I put my back together, sometimes nobody wants to hear that. It's almost like it doesn't rhyme.
Eileen Peltier is Sports Boyfriend in Studio 435 tonight. She's going to be playing at Shuba's coming up here on Wednesday, Tomorrow Never Knows Festival. And you can find all her information as Sports Boyfriend, Bandcamp, iTunes, Spotify, all that. Jazz, the latest single is I Only Leave My House to Dance With You. That was Jasmine in the Summer. You know, it's the one thing I want from you is more music. Like I want you to produce more music. What I mean, you've put out a couple of singles, and you've been able to have some songs on SoundCloud. You ever think about putting it all together, and are we going to get an album in 2018 from Sports Boyfriend?
Yeah, I definitely want to put, like, at least, like, a 6 or 7 song something out, like, just to kind of have everything collected, and so it's sort of, you know, I'll probably get it, like, actually mastered and then have it all, you know, on Spotify and stuff, because right now it's sort of floating around random places.
Do you make plans at the beginning of the year to say, this is what I want to do in 2018, or this is what I want to put out in 2018?
Not really. I mean, before, like, very recently, I didn't really know. I hadn't really, like, committed to doing anything more. It just sort of, things kept happening, and I just kept saying yes to things. But also, I try not to put, like, too much pressure on myself, because the way that I work is kind of just, like, you know, if I sometimes there'll be a couple months where I don't write anything that I really like, and I would never want to be, like, you know, committed to putting, like, 10 songs out and only have, like, 7 or 8 that I really liked, you know? So I kind now that I have, like, enough, I think I'll definitely try to put something out within
as,
the next few
as
months.
A producer, as someone who puts the music together and also plays guitar and also sings, what comes first? What is it? I mean, if you come up with a sick beat, as the kids say, do you say, oh, I got to come up with some lyrics for this? I mean, talk about just how you assemble a song.
I would say that it usually starts out with, like, sort of like a hooky, like, catchphrase or something, sort of like the repeated part of the song, I guess, like almost like an idea for the chorus. And then I'll try to come up with a really, like, simple beat. And then what I've been doing recently is I'll write a bass line. Because that's probably the most important part of the song to me. And then I'll just, like, layer guitar over it usually until I have something that I really like. And then after that, I'll go in again and kind of do different, you know, keys, whatever other things I think will make the song better. But I would say it's definitely sort of, like, a little bit of the words first. But then usually the rest of the song I write over that kind of sketch of a track. Right. And just sort of mumble over it until I like the melody. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a process that needs to be in album form, right? Eileen Peltier is Sports Boyfriend. She is playing at Shuba's for the Tomorrow Never Knows Festival, which is coming up on Wednesday. Shuba's at Belmont and Southport and Lakeview. You can find out all her stuff at Bandcamp, of course, iTunes, Spotify, all that kind of stuff. The latest single was I Only Leave My House to Dance With You. And we just heard Jasmine in the Summer, which was a single before that. Eileen, thanks so much for joining us in Studio 435, and we look forward to Sports Boyfriend albums in 2018.
Thank you so much for having me.